V. Cooling duct, according to Narish. They're probably under there. We have to go in through here. They have come halfway down the slope to a pump house built into the earthworks for the cold water that used to carry off the tremendous heat from the test firings. It is stripped now, hollow and dark inside. Flothrop isn't two steps over the doorsill when he walks into somebody. "Beg your pardon," though it comes out less than calmly. "Oh, that's all right," Russian accent. "I don't mind at all." He backs Flothrop outside again. Oh, a mean-looking junior sergeant here about 8 or 9 feet high. "Well, now," at which point Narish comes walking into them. "Oh," Narish blinks at the sentry. "Sergeant, don't you hear that music? Why aren't you back at the assembly building with your comrades? There are, I understand, a number of eager fräuleins entertaining them." Nudge, nudge. "In a most enchanting state of deshabille, too." "I suppose that's all perfectly divine," replies the sentry, "for some people. Cut, so much for tactics. And besides, this is out of bounds, you big sillies." Sighing, Narish raises his bottle aloft, brings it down or up. Thunk on the sentry's nape, dislodging the man's helmet liner, is what happens. "Naughty," the Russian, somewhat nettled, stoops to retrieve his headgear. "Really, I ought to put you both under apprehension." "Enough chit-chat," snarls Slothrop, brandishing his glowing cigar and Molotov cocktail. "Hand over that gun there, Ivan, or I turn you into a human flare." "You're mean," sulks the sentry, unslinging his Dektyarov a little too quickly. Flothrop dodges aside, aims his usual swift kick to the groin, which misses, but does knock loose the weapon, which Narish is thoughtful enough to die for. "Beasts," whimpers the Russian. "Oh, nasty, awful," scampering off into the night. 2 minutes. Narish already inside the pump house. Flothrop grabs the automatic from him and follows at a run, accelerating down a sloping corridor. Their feet ring faster, sharper on the concrete, down to a metal door. Behind it, they can hear Springer singing and babbling like a drunk. Flothrop pushes off his safety, and Narish goes busting in. A pretty blonde auxiliary in black boots and steel-rimmed glasses is sitting here, taking down shorthand notes of everything she hears from Springer, who leans happily, grandiose, against a cold water pipe, 4 feet high, that runs the length of the room. "Drop that pencil," orders Flothrop. "All right, where's that Major Zhdaev?" "He's in conference, if you'd care to leave your name." "Dope!" Narish screams. "They have given him some kind of dope. Gerhardt, speak to me." Flothrop recognizes the symptoms. "It's that sodium amytal. It's okay, let's go." "I expect the major to be back any moment. They're upstairs in the guard room smoking. Is there a number where he can reach you?" Flothrop has slid under one of Springer's arms, Narish under the other, when there's this loud hammering on the door. "Smoking? Smoking what?" "This way, Flothrop." "Oh." They hustle Springer out another door, which Flothrop bolts and rattles a heavy filing cabinet up against. Then they drag Springer up a flight of steps into a long, straight corridor, lit by 6 or 7 bulbs, the spaces between which are very dark. Along either side, floor to ceiling, run thick bundles of measurement cabling.
"We're done for,"
Narish wheezes. It's 150 yards to the measurement bunker, and no cover but the shadows between the bulbs. All these birds gotta do is spray a pattern.
"She baffs at nothing, the hetero-speed," cries Gerhardt von Gerl.
"Try to walk," Slothrop, scared shit. "Come on, man, it's our ass." Smashing echoes after them down the tunnel. A muffled burst of automatic fire, and another. All at once, 2 faint pools of light ahead. Zhdaev materializes on the way back to his office. He has a friend with him, who smiles when he sees Slothrop 40 yards away, a big steel smile. Slothrop lets go of Springer and runs up into the next light, peace at the ready. The Russians are blinking at him in a puzzled way.
"Chichirin, hey!"
They stand facing, each at his lit circle. Slothrop recalls that he has the drop on them. He smiles in half-apology, tips the muzzle at them, moves closer. Zhdaev and Chichirin, after a discussion which seems unnecessarily long, decide they will raise their hands.
"Rocket man!"
"Howdy.
What are you doing in a fascist uniform like that?"
"You're right. Think I'll join the Red Army instead." Narish leaves Springer sagging against a row of sleek rubber and silver mesh cables and comes up to help disarm the 2 Russians. Troops back down the tunnel are still busy busting the door down.
"You guys want to undress here? Say, Chichirin, how'd you like that hashish, by the way?"
"Well," taking off his trousers, "we were all up there in the budka just now smoking some. Rocket man, your timing is fantastic. Zhdaev, isn't he something?"
Slothrop slides out of his tux.
"Just see you don't get a hard-on here now, fella."
"I'm serious. It's your Schwarz phenomenon.
Quit fooling. You don't even know about it. It choreographs you.
Mine's always trying to destroy me. We should be exchanging those instead of uniforms. The disguise business grows complicated. Shdaev's jacket with the gold-starred pogoni on the shoulders gets draped around the Springer, who is now humming everyone a court viol medley. Shdaev puts on Springer's white suit, and then him and Chicherny get tied up with their own belts, hey, and neckties. Now, the idea, Sothrup explains, being that you, Chicherny, will be posing as me, and the major there, at which point the door back down the tunnel comes blasting open, two figures with wicked Suomi subs, drums on them as big as that Jean Krupa's, come flying through. Sothrup stands in the light in Chicherny's uniform and waves dramatically, pointing at the two hog-tied officers. Make it good, he mutters to Chicherny. I'm trusting you now, but look out, I have a great passive vocabulary. I'll know what you're saying. It's okay with Chicherny, but confusing. I'm supposed to be who now? Oh, shit, look, just tell them to go check out the pump house up there. It's urgent. Sothrup gestures and lip-syncs while Chicherny talks. It seems to work. The two actually salute and go back through the door they just shot down. Those apes, Chicherny shakes his head. Those black apes. How did you know, Rocket Man? Of course you didn't, but the Schwarz Phenomen did. A great touch. Two of them looking at me through the window, and I thought, well, you know, I thought just about what you thought I'd think. But by this time, Sothrup is way out of earshot. Springer by now is able to stumble at a fast walk. They get as far as the measurement bunker without running into anybody. Out a door of bulletproof glass, behind their own reflections, is the old test frame. Windows broken out, camouflage in German expressionist ripples, streaming gray and black all over it. The two soldiers are sure enough up there poking around that pump house, finding nothing. Presently, they disappear inside again, and Narish opens the door. Hurry! They edge outside into the arena. It takes a while to get back up the slope and into the woods. Otto and Hilda show up. They've finessed Zhdaev's car and driver out of a rotor arm, so there are four of them now to try and lift warbling payload Gerhard von Gerl up these few crummy feet of sand embankment here. Gotta be the most ill-designed propulsion system this test stand has seen in a while. Otto and Hilda tug at Springer's arms. Narish and Slothra push from the ass end. About halfway up, Springer blows a tremendous fart that echoes for minutes across the historic ellipse, like now to do for you folks my anal impression of the A4. Oh, fuck you, Sothrup snarls. An erect green steed of planetoid and bone, nods the Springer in reply. Music and chatter back by the assembly building have all died away now, and an unpleasant calm has replaced them. Up over the top at last and into the woods, where Springer rests his forehead against a tree trunk and commences vomiting violently. Narish, we're risking our ass for this slob. But Narish is busy helping squeeze his friend's stomach. Gerhard, are you all right? What can I do? Beautiful, chokes Springer, vomit trickling down his chin. Ah, feels great. Along come chimps, musicians, dancing girls, drifting into rendezvous, over the last dune and down to the packed cinder triangle of test stand 10 and the sea. The musicians for a while play a kind of march tune. Past the foreshore, the tide has left them a strip of sand, but Frau Knob is nowhere in sight. Haftung is holding hands with an ape. Felix shakes spit out of his tuba. A honey-haired chorus girl, whose name he never does get, puts her arms around Slothrup. I'm scared. Me too, he hugs her. All hell breaks loose. Sirens, whoop-whooping. Searchlights starting to probe the woods up above, truck motors and shouted commands. The crash-out party move off the cinders and crouch in marsh grass. We've collected one automatic and two sidearms, Narish whispers. They'll be coming at us from the south. It'll only take one of us to go back up and hold them. He nods and begins checking his hardware. You're crazy, hisses Slothrup. They'll kill you. Commotion now from over by test stand 7. Headlights are appearing one after another along the road up there. Narish taps Springer on the chin. It isn't clear if Springer knows who he is. Labor vol, anyway, Springer. Negant's stuck in overcoat pockets, automatic cradled in his arms. Narish takes off at a crouching run along the beach and doesn't look back. Where's the boat? Haftung in a white panic. Ducks, alarmed, are quacking at each other down here. Wind moves in the grass. When searchlights move by, pine trunks uphill flare, deeply shining, terrible. And at everyone's back, the Baltic shakes and streams. Shots from uphill. Then, maybe from Narish in reply, a burst of automatic fire. Otto is holding his Hilda close. Anybody read Morse code? The girl next to Slothrup wants to know, because there's been a light going over there, see, at the tip of that little island, for a few minutes now. It's three dots, dot, dot, three more dots, over and over. Seas, ponders Felix. Maybe they're not dots, says the tenor sax player. Maybe they're dashes. That's funny, says Otto. That would spell Otto. That's your name, says Hilda. Mother, screams Otto, running out in the water and waving at the blinking light. Felix commences booming tuba notes across the water, and the rest of the band joins in. Reed shadows come stabbing across the sand as the spotlights swoop down. A boat engine roars into hearing. Here she comes, Otto jumping up and down in the marsh. Hey, Narish, Gothrop squinting, trying to find him back there in light that was always too weak. Come on, fall back. No answer, but more shooting. Running lights off, the boat comes barreling in at flank speed. Frau Knopp has decided to ram Peenemünde. No, now she puts everything full astern. Bearings shriek, screw foam, geysers. The boat slews around to a stop. Get on board, she bellows. Slothrop's been hollering for Narish. Frau Knob leans on her steam whistle, but no answer. Kit, I've got to get him. Felix and Otto grab Slothrop from behind, drag him back to the boat, kicking and cursing. They'll kill him, you assholes. Let me go. Dark shapes come spilling over the dune between here and Test Stand 7. Orange flickers at their midsections, the sound of rifle fire following a second later. They will kill us. Otto heaves Slothrop over the side and tumbles in after. Spotlights find and skewer them now. The firing is louder, nipples and spatters in the water, slugs hammering into the boat. Everybody here? The Frau's fangs bared in a grin. Fine, fine. The last ape reaches up. Haftung catches his hands and he dangles feet in the water for several yards as they light out all ahead full till he can finally clamber up and over. Gunfire follows out to sea, out of range, at last out of earshot. Hey, Felix, says the tenor sax player. You think there's any gigs in Swinemünde?
John Dillinger, at the end, found a few seconds' strange mercy in the movie images that hadn't quite yet faded from his eyeballs. Clark Gable going off unregenerate to fry in the chair, voices gentle out of the death row steel, so long, Blackie. Turning down a reprieve from his longtime friend, now Governor of New York, William Powell, skinny, chinless, condescending jerk, Gable just wanting to get it over with. Die like you live, all of a sudden, don't drag it out. Even as bitchy little Melvin Purvis, staked outside the Biograph Theater, lit up the fatal cigar and felt already between his lips the penis of official commendation, and federal cowards at the signal took Dillinger with their faggots' precision, there was still, for the doomed man, some shift of personality in effect. The way you felt, for a little while afterward, in the real muscles of your face and voice, that you were Gable. The ironic eyebrows, the proud, shining, snake-like head, to help Dillinger through the bushwhacking and a little easier into death. Narish now, huddled inside a broken few meters of concrete drainage pipe, after doubling back under the wall of Test Stand 7, bracing curled now in the smell of old storm water, trying not to breathe loud enough to smack echoes into any betrayal, Narish hasn't been to a movie since Der Müde Tod, that so long ago he's forgotten its ending. The last Rilke elegiac shot of weary death leading the two lovers away hand in hand through the forget-me-nots. No help at all from that quarter. Tonight Narish is down to the last Tommy gun of his career, foreign and overheated, and blisters on his hands he won't have to worry about tomorrow. No sources of mercy available beyond the hard weapon, the burning fingers, a cruel way to go out for a good guidance man who always put in fair time for fair wages. He had other offers. Could have gone east with the Institute Rabe or west to America and $6 a day. But Gerhard von Göhl promised him glamour, jackpots, a flashy dame on his arm, say, why not on both arms, after poor linear Peenemünde, who could blame him? It wasn't ever necessary to see around the entire plan. Really, that's asking too much of anyone, not true? This escalate strategy he's going out of his way to die for tonight, what does he know of the Springer's full intentions in the affair? It is reasonable to Narish that he, being smaller, he should be the sacrifice, if it helps Springer survive, even survive another day. Wartime thinking, yeah, but too late to change. Did the escalate program at Nordhausen in its time ever hint that so many individuals, nations, firms, communities of interest would come after the fact? Of course he was flattered then at being chosen to work on the modification to the guidance, minor as it was, hardly worth the special treatment. Still, it was his first high historical moment, and he sourly figured it to be his last, up until meeting with Springer's recruiting team back during the rainier part of June. Conferences in cafes and entrances to churchyards around Braunschweig. Stucco arches, vines dripping onto thin collars. Without an umbrella, but with that light, belled hope inside. A field crowded with lines of force to expand, to fill, to keep him in good health and spirits. Berlin, the Chicago cabaret. Cocaine or cards? An old movie line the Gunsels loved to use that summer. The big time. But the ringing bright thing inside brought him here instead, here, down in a pipe, to only a handful more of minutes. The idea was always to carry along a fixed quantity. A. Sometimes you'd use a Wien bridge, tuned to a certain frequency, A sub T, whistling, heavy with omen, inside the electric corridors. While outside, according to the tradition in these matters, somewhere a quantity B would be gathering, building as the rocket gathered speed. So, up till assigned Brennschluss velocity, V asterisk sub 1, electric shocked as any rat into following this very narrow mazeway of clear space. Yes, radio signals from the ground would enter the rocket body, and by reflex, literally by electric signal traveling a reflex arc, the control surfaces twitch to steer you back on course the instant you'd begin to wander off. How could you've kept from lapsing up here into that radiant inattention, so caught up in the wind, the sheer altitude, the unimaginable fires at your feet? So, for that tightly steered passage, all was carried on in the sharpest, most painful anticipation, with B always growing as palpably cresting as the assault of tidal wave that stills every small creature and hones the air down to a cold stir. Your quantity A, shining, constant A, carried as they must have once packed far overland at night the grail, in their old time and military bleakness of humor, and one morning a wide upper lip steel-wool gray with the one day's growth, the fatal, the terrible sign. He shaved smooth every day. It meant that this was the last day, and too, with only the grim sixth sense, as much faith as clear reception, that the B of many subscripts just over the electric horizon was really growing closer. Perhaps this time as B sub IW, the precession angle of the gyro moving invisibly but felt, terrifically arousing over the metal frame toward angle A sub IW, which is how they have set you the contacts. To close, you must see, at that exact angle. Or as B sub IL, another integrating not of gyro rate but of the raw current flow itself, bled from the moving coil inside the poles, the fettered pendulum. They thought this way, design group, in terms of captivity, prohibition. There was an attitude toward one's hardware more brutal and soldierly than most engineers got the chance to be. They felt quite the roughshod elite. Dreiveling and Schmeil, with the fluorescent lights shining on his bared forehead night after night. Inside their brains, they shared an old, old electro-decor, variable capacitors of glass, kerosene for a dielectric, brass plates and ebonite covers, Zeiss galvanometers with thousands of fine-threaded adjusting screws, Siemens milliameters set on slate surfaces, terminals designated by Roman numerals, standard ohms of manganese wire in oil, the old Gilscher thermosäule, that operated on heating gas, put out 4 volts, nickel and antimony, asbestos funnels on top, mica tubing. Wasn't that life more decent than gangstering? A cleaner sort of friendship, less devious anyway. There we saw how we had to fit in. The machinery itself determined that. Everything was so clear then. Paranoia was all for the enemy and never for one's own. What about the SS? Oh, they were the enemy, I'd say. After. No, Klaus, don't drift away, please, not onto dreams of kindly Soviet interrogation that will end in some ermine bed, some vodka-perfumed stupor. You know that's foolish. B. B sub N for Nerish is nearly here, nearly about to burn through the last whispering veil to equal A, to equal the only fragment of himself left by them to go through the moment, the irreducible doll of German styrene, shabbier, less authentic than any earlier self, a negligible quantity in this last light, this tattoo of hunter's boots and rifle bolts in oiled keyways. Here come Enzian, Andreas, and Christian, coming on like Smith, Klein, and French.
crashing into the basement room, field gray kit, newspaper shoes, rolled trouser cuffs, hands and bare forearms shining with motor oil and gear grease, toting carbines in a show of force. But no empty ones here to see them. It's too late. Just the mute bed and the brown ellipse her blood made on the torn ticking. And washing blue in grainy splashes in the corners under the bed. Their signature, their challenge.
Where is she?
Christian is just this side of berserk. One word astray and he'll be off to kill the first empty one he finds. Maria, his sister, is, was, may be.
We'd better...
Enzian already back out the door. Where's, her husband, you know? Pavel. Christian wants to see his eyes, but Enzian won't turn. Pavel and Maria meant to have the child. Then Joseph Umbindi and his people started their visiting. They have learned their vulturehood from the Christian missionaries. They keep lists of all the women of childbearing age. Any pregnancy is an invitation to hover, to tune in, to swoop. They will use threats, casuistry, physical seduction. There's an arsenal of techniques. Washing blue is the abortifacient of choice.
The refinery, suggests Andreas Orukambe.
Really? I thought he'd sworn off that. Maybe not now. The girl's brother stares him hard as fists. Enzian, old bastard, you really are out of touch. They remount their motorcycles and head off again. Blasted dry docks, charcoal ribs of warehouses, cylindrical chunks of submarine that never got assembled, go ripping by in the darkness. British security are about, but that's another encapsulated world. The British G5 occupy their own space and zone congruent but not identical to what these serious Schwarzkommando astride bikes unmuffled go blasting on through tonight. Separations are proceeding. Each alternative zone speeds away from all the others in fated acceleration, red shifting, fleeing the center. Each day the mythical return Enzian dreamed of seems less possible. Once it was necessary to know uniforms, insignia, airplane markings, to observe boundaries, but by now too many choices have been made. The single route lost, way back there in the May desolation. Each bird has his branch now, and each one is the zone. A crowd of DPs is milling by the ruin of an ornamental fountain. A score of them, eyes of ash, smudged into faces white as salt. The Hereros go swerving by them, halfway up a shallow flight of long steps, dovetailing into the grade of the street. Teeth slamming together upper and lower, cycle frames squeaking shrill, up and down the steps past wordless plosions of Slavic breath, ashes and salt. A sound truck appears around a wall 100 meters away. The voice, university, but in long tired of the message, recites, "Clear the streets. Go to your homes."
Clear the... Go to your what?
There must be a mistake. It must be for some other town. We're underneath an oil pipeline, up on trestles running down leftward to the water now, huge bolted flanges overhead softened by rust and oily dirt. Far out in the harbor rides an oil tanker, rocking, serene as a web of stars. Zoom uphill slantwise toward a rampart of wasted, knotted, fused, and scorched girderwork. Stacks, pipes, ducting, windings, fairings, insulators, reconfigured by all the bombing. Grease-stained pebblery on the ground rushing by a mile a minute. And wait, wait, say what, say reconfigured now?
It doesn't exactly dawn, no, but there breaks. As that light you're afraid will break some night at too deep an hour to explain away,
there floods on Enzian what seems to him an extraordinary understanding. This serpentine slag heap he is just about to ride into now, this ex-refinery, Jampf Ölfabriken Werke AG, is not a ruin at all. It is in perfect working order. Only waiting for the right connections to be set up, to be switched on, modified precisely, deliberately, by bombing that was never hostile, but part of a plan both sides, had always agreed on. Yes, and now what if we... All right, say we are supposed to be the Kabbalists out here. Say that's our real destiny, to be the scholar magicians of the zone, with somewhere in it a text, to be picked to pieces, annotated, explicated, and masturbated till it's all squeezed limp of its last drop. Well, we assumed, natürlich, that this holy text had to be the rocket. Orururumo Orunene. The high, rising, dead, the blazing, the great one. Orunene is already being modified by the zone Herero children to Amunene, the eldest brother, our Torah. What else? Its symmetries, its latencies, the cuteness of it enchanted and seduced us while the real text persisted. Somewhere else, in its darkness, our darkness. Even this far from Sudvest, we are not to be spared the ancient tragedy of lost messages, a curse that will never leave us. But if I'm riding through it, the real text right now, if this is it, or if I passed it today somewhere in the devastation of Hamburg, breathing the ash dust, missing it completely, if what the IG built on this site were not at all the final shape of it, but only an arrangement of fetishes, commands to call down special tools in the form of 8th Air Force bombers, yes, the Allied planes, all would have been ultimately IG built by way of Director Krupp through his English interlocks. The bombing was the exact industrial process of conversion. Each release of energy placed exactly in space and time. Each shockwave plotted in advance to bring precisely tonight's wreck into being, thus decoding the text, thus coding, recoding, de-recoding the holy text. If it is in working order, what is it meant to do? The engineers who built it as a refinery never knew there were any further steps to be taken. Their design was finalized, and they could forget it. It means this war was never political at all. The politics was all theater, all just to keep the people distracted, secretly. It was being dictated instead by the needs of technology, by a conspiracy between human beings and techniques, by something that needed the energy burst of war, crying, "Money be damned, the very life of," insert name of nation, "is at stake." But meaning, most likely, dawn is nearly here, I need my night's blood, my funding, funding, ah, more, more. The real crises were crises of allocation and priority, not among firms. It was only staged to look that way, but among the different technologies, plastics, electronics, aircraft, and their needs, which are understood only by the ruling elite. Yes, but technology only responds. How often this argument has been iterated, dogged and humorless as a Gaussian reduction, among the younger Schwarzkommando especially. All very well to talk about having a monster by the tail, but do you think we'd have had the rocket if someone, some specific somebody with a name and a penis, hadn't wanted to chuck a ton of Amitol 300 miles and blow up a block full of civilians? Go ahead, capitalize the T on technology. Deify it if it'll make you feel less responsible. But it puts you in with the neutered, brother, in with the eunuchs keeping the harem of our stolen earth for the numb and joyless hard-ons of human sultans, human elite, with no right at all to be where they are. We have to look for power sources here, and distribution networks we were never taught, routes of power our teachers never imagined or were encouraged to avoid. We have to find meters whose scales are unknown in the world, draw our own schematics, getting feedback, making connections, reducing the error, trying to learn the real function, zeroing in on what incalculable plot. Up here on the surface, coal tars, hydrogenation, synthesis were always phony, dummy functions to hide the real, the planetary mission. Yes, perhaps centuries in the unrolling. This ruinous plant, waiting for its Kabbalists and new alchemists to discover the key, teach the mysteries to others. And if it isn't exactly Jampf-Ölfabrikenwerke, what if it's the Krupp works in Essen? What if it's Blohm and Voss right here in Hamburg, or another make-believe ruin in another city, another country? Yah! Well, this is stimulant talk here. Yes, Enzian's been stuffing down Nazi surplus pervitins these days like popcorn at the movies. And now the bulk of the refinery, named incidentally for the famous discoverer of Onarein, is behind them. And Enzian is on into some other paranoid terror, talking, though each man's wind and motor cuts him off from conversation. Sort of a Hoagy Carmichael piano can be heard in behind this here. Just a daredevil desoxyphedrin daddy with my pockets full of happy days, zooming through the zone where the wild dogs roam, giving all my dreams away. Took the tubes out of my radio, don't mean a thing to me. Wouldn't spend a nickel on the stars and stripes, 'cause I'm doing my own for free. Mouth keeps going, nobody listening, gabbing at a terrible pace. Oh, you're so sly, but I wave goodbye with a shit-eaten grin on my face. Don't you ephedrine of me, my honey, swoon just to hear my name. In the curfew cells, when all the lights are gone, oh, everything'll be the same, just light the candles. Everything'll be the same. Last night, in his journal, Enzian wrote, "The mouth lately has been too much in service, too little coming out of use to anybody. A defense, oh God, then they really are getting at me. Please, I don't want to pontificate this way. I know what my voice sounds like, heard it at Peenemünde years ago on Weissmann's dictaphone. Chrome and Bakelite. Too high, obnoxious, Berliner Schnauze. How they must wince inside whenever I begin to speak. I could go tomorrow. I know how to be alone. It doesn't frighten me as much as they do. They take endlessly, but they never use what they take. What do they think they can take from me? They don't want my patriarchy. They don't want my love. They don't want my information or my work or my energy or what I own. I don't own anything. There's no money anymore. Nobody's seen any out here for months. No, it can't be money. Cigarettes? I never have enough cigarettes. If I left them, where could I go? Back among the reservoir tanks now, into the evening wind, skidding on this synthetic waste field, all of it ungraded blackness. Christian's motor seems to be missing now and then, dithering toward a stall. Spot decision. If he breaks down, let him walk. That way less trouble if Pavel's there. If he's not there, pick up Christian on the way back and see about getting a truck out to repair it. Keep it simple. That's the mark of a great leader, Enzian. Christian doesn't break down, though, and Pavel turns out to be there, sort of. Well, not there, the way Enzian in his current state of mind would consider for very long. But present, all right, along with an amazing collection of friends who always seem to show up whenever he comes to sniff Leuna gasoline, such as, oh, the moss creature here, brightest green you can imagine. More burning than fluorescent, lurking over in a corner of the field tonight, shy, stirring like an infant now and then. Or how about the water giant, a mile-high visitor made all of flowing water who likes to dance, twisting from the waist, arms blowing loosely along the sky? When the Umbindi people took Maria off to find their doctor in Hamburg, voices began calling, voices of the fungus pygmies, who breed in the tanks at the interface between fuel and water bottom, began to call to him, Pavel, Omunene, why don't you come back to see us? We miss you. Why have you stayed away? Not much fun for them down here at the interface, competing with the bacteria who cruise by in their country of light, these cellular aristocracy, approaching the wall of hydrocarbons, each for his share of God's abundance, leaving their wastes a green murmur, a divergently unstable gabbling, a slime that grows with the days thicker, more poisonous. It is a depressing thing indeed to be a pygmy clustered together with thousands of others. Hundreds of thousands that have to live on the other side of all this. You say other side? What do you mean? What other side? You mean in the gasoline? Blustered pygmies playfully into some well-known swing riff. No, no. No, no. You mean in the water then? CP. No, no. No, no. Well, you gotta tell me, please, for I drop my BVDs. We mean, exclaimed the pygmies, gathering their little heads into a symmetrical cauliflower pattern and settling into a soft, wistful a cappella like kids around the campfire with Bing Crosby in a baseball cap. Yes, these Leuna hallucinationen have been known to get weird, all right. Weirder than cultural shock, even. This here is meta-shocks, what it is. Three sigma white faces in a ritual whose mystery is deeper than north light over the Kalahari. We mean on the other side of the whole thing, the whole bacteria hydrocarbon waste cycle. We can see the interface from here. It's a long rainbow, mostly indigo, if that's any help. Indigo and Kelly green. Bing, directing, raises up all these brainwashed little Irish faces in a moving, firelit crescendo. Green, gasoline, between, submarine, fading, because by then Pavel was on his way out to the refinery. Forget this 2.5 weeks of self-imposed torture. Umbindi's men after him down by the glass-wool boiler pipes, men and women both trying to caress him, pressure from both sides of the tribal suicide question. Enzian complaining, too entangled with the rocket, too encrimsoned in his feud with the Russian to care much about anyone outside himself. And here Pavel was trying to stay away from this, from the breath of Mukuru, only trying to be a good man. The moss creature stirs. It has crept an alarming distance closer since Pavel last looked. A sudden overflow of smooth cherry red down the mountainside to his right. Were there mountains? Where did the mountains come from? And at once he knows, beyond deception or hope, that he has slipped into the north, that inhaling the breath of the first ancestor has taken him over into the terrible land, as he must have known it would, step by step over these last years. Impossible to turn. What is turn? Don't know which way to begin to move. Don't know how to move. Too late. Miles and changes too late. And now his head in Christian's steel notch at 300 yards. Suddenly this awful branching, the two possibilities already beginning to fly apart at the speed of thought. A new zone in any case now, whether Christian fires or refrains. Jump. Choose. Enzian tries his best, knocks the barrel aside, has a few unpleasant words for the young revenger, but both men saw the new branches. The zone, again, has just changed, and they are already on into the new one. They ride on up to where Pavel's sniffing synthetic gasoline on the side of the lampless beige hill under the tanks, snailing whitely to heaven. Here he is. one of the IG's happiest customers. Does Pavel know something the rest of us don't? If the IG wanted this to be a cover-up for something else, why not the breath of Mukuru? Enzian can project himself back in the Erzfeinhöhle, starting a new file on the IG. See it getting fatter and fatter as the interlocks develop. The books are audited, the witnesses come, not forward, but sideways at least, always in shadows. And if it should prove not to be the rocket, not the IG, why then, he'll have to go on, won't he? On to something else. The Volkswagen factory, the pharmaceutical companies. And if it isn't even in Germany, then he'll have to start in America or in Russia. And if he dies before they find the true text to study, then there'll have to be machinery for others to carry it on. Say, that's a swell idea. Call the whole Erzfeinhöhle together, get up there, say, my people, I have had a vision. No, but there will need to be more staff, if it's to be that big a search. Quiet shifting of resources away from the rocket, diversifying while making it look like an organic growth. And who to bring in on it? Christian. Can he use the boy now? Christian's anger. Will it use Christian, regardless, to help suppress Umbindi? Because if the Schwarzkommando mission in the zone has been truly revealed just now, then there'll have to be something done about Umbindi. Empty ones. Doctrine of the final zero. More staff will mean more zone hereros, not fewer. More information coming in about the enemy. More connections made will mean a greater threat to the people, will mean that tribal numbers will have to increase. Is there an alternative? No, he would rather ignore Umbindi, but the needs of this new search will not allow him that comfort now. The search will rule. Somewhere among the wastes of the world is the key that will bring us back, restore us to our earth and to our freedom. Andreas has been talking with Pavel, who is still out with his strangely lighted companions, playing at this and that. Presently, with love and subterfuge, he gets the address of Umbindi's medical connection. Enzian knows who he is. St. Pauli, let's go. Your machine running a little rough, Christian? Don't sweet-talk me, Christian explodes. You don't care about me. You don't care about my sister. She's dying out there, and you just keep plugging her into your equations. You play this Holy Father routine, and inside that ego, you don't even hate us. You don't care. You're not even connected anymore. He swings his fist at Enzian's face. He's crying. Enzian stands there and lets him. It hurts. He lets it. His meekness isn't all politics, either. He can feel enough of the bone truth in what Christian said. Maybe not all of it, not all at once, but enough. You just connected. Can we go after her now? Here is the good Frau leaning over Slothrop from way down at the foot of the bed, her eye bright and cocky as a parrot's, a big white boss of eye cantilevered on old prickly arms and legs, a black kerchief above the roll of her pompadour in mourning for all her Hanseatic dead, underneath heaving iron fleets, under waves of the Baltic, keel-edged and gray, dead under the fleets of waves, the prairies of the sea. Next thing is Gerhard von Girl's foot nudging Slothrop in a less than tender way. The sun is up and all the girls have gone. Otto crouches around deck with a broom and swab, removing yesterday's chimpanzee shit. Swinemünde. The Springer is his old chipper self. Fresh eggs and coffee in the pilot house, fall to. We're due out of here in 15 minutes. Well, just belay that wee, Ace. But I need your help. Springer's wearing a suit of fine tweed this morning. Very Savile Row, fits perfectly. Nerish needed your help. You don't know what you're talking about. His eyes are steelies that never lose. His laugh, subtitled Humoring the Fools, is Mitteleuropäisch and mirthless. All right, how much do you want? Everything's got a price, right? But he's not being noble here, no. What it is that his own price has just occurred to him, and he needs to shim the talk here, give it a second to breathe and develop. Everything? What's the deal? A minor piracy. Pick up one package for me while I cover you. He looks at his watch, hamming it up. Okay, get me a discharge. I'll come with you. A what? A discharge for you? You ought to laugh more, Springer. It makes you look really cute. What kind of a discharge, Slothrop? Honorable, perhaps? Ah, aha, ha-ha! Like Adolf Hitler, Springer is easily tickled by what the Germans call Schadenfreude, the feeling of joy at another's misfortune. Quit fooling, I'm serious. Of course you are, Slothrop. More giggling. Slothrop waits, watches, sucking on an egg, though he feels anything but sly this morning.
Nerys, you see, were supposed to go with me today. Now I'm stuck with you. Where do you want it delivered, this discharge?
Cuxhaven. Fawthorpe has been having lately this dim fantasy about trying to contact the Operation Backfire people in Cuxhaven to see if they'll help get him out. They seem to be the only English connection to the rocket anymore. He knows already it won't work. He and Springer arrange a date anyhow. Be at a place called Putzi's. It's down the Durham Road. Local dealers will be able to tell you where. So it's out once again, out past the mole's wet embrace into the Baltic, crest to crest, and into nimbus piling sheet on sheet bounces the jolly pirate bark, into a day already squally and bitter and getting worse. Springer stands outside the pilot house, hollering in above the sound of heavy seas that splash back over the bow and down the decks.
Where do you make her?
If it's Copenhagen she's bound for, Frau Knob's windburned face, permanent smile creases all around her eyes and mouth, beaming like the sun,
can't have more than an hour on us.
Visibility this morning is too low to see the coast of Usedom. Springer joins Slothrop at the rail, looking at nothing, breathing the closing smell of gray weather.
He's all right, Slothrop. He's seen worse. 2 months ago in Berlin, we got ambushed right outside the Chicago. He walked through crossfire from three Schmeissers to offer our competitors a deal. Not a scratch.
Springer, he was going round and round with half the Russian army up there.
They won't kill him. They know who he is. He worked in guidance. He was Schilling's best man. He knows more about integrating circuits than anybody they'll find outside of Garmisch now. The Russians are offering fantastic salaries, better than the Americans. And they'll let him stay in Germany, work at Peenemünde or the Mittelwerke, just like he used to. He can even escape if that's what he wants. We have very good connections for that. But what if they did shoot him? No, they weren't supposed to. Springer, this ain't the fucking movies now. Come on. Not yet, maybe not quite yet. You'd better enjoy it while you can. Someday, when the film is fast enough, the equipment pocket-size and burdenless and selling at people's prices, the lights and booms no longer necessary, then...
We now come in sight of mythical Rügen off our starboard bow. Its chalk cliffs are brighter than the sky. There is mist in the firths and among the green oaks. Along the beaches drift pearl patches of fog. Our captain, Frau Knab, heads into the Greifswalder Boden to comb the long firths for her quarry. After an hour, comical bassoon solos over close-ups of the old recreant guzzling some horrible fermented potato mash lobotomy out of a jerry can, wiping her mouth on her sleeve, belching. A fruitless search, our modern-day pirates head out to sea again and up the eastern coast of the island. Light rain has been falling. Otto breaks out slickers and a thermos of hot soup. Clouds, a dozen shades of gray, go scudding along the sky. Great misty heaps of rock, steep cliffs, streams in deep gorges, gray and green, and spires of white chalk in the rain, go passing. The Stubenkammer, the king's seat, and presently, off to port, Cape Arcona, where waves crash at the base of the cliffs, and on top the groves of white-trunked trees are blowing. The ancient Slavs put up a temple here, to Svetovit, their god of fertility and war. Old Svetovit did business under quite a number of aliases. Three-headed Triglaf, five-headed Borovit, seven-faced Rugevit. Tell that to your boss next time he talks about wearing two hats. Now, as Arcona slides away off our port quarter, there she is, Otto calls from the top of the pilot house. Far, far away, hauling out to sea from behind the Visov Klinken, the pale limestone latchkey with which Providence today is probing the wards of Slothrop's heart, barely visible in the rain, dips a tiny, white ghost of a ship. Get a bearing, Frau Knob, grabbing the wheel and bracing her feet. We want a collision course. Otto crouches by the Pylorus, shivering. Here, Slothrop. Luger, box of rounds?
What? Came this morning with the egg delivery.
You didn't mention...
He may be a little exercised, but he's a realist. Your friend Greta and I knew him in Warsaw in the old days.
Springer, tell me, Springer, now, what ship is that? Springer hands him some binoculars. In fine gold lettering behind the golden jackal on the wraith-white bow is the name he already knows. Okay. Trying to see through the rain into Springer's eyes, you knew I was aboard. You're setting me up now, right?
When were you on board?
Come on. Look, Nerys was going after the package today, not you. We didn't even know you.
Do you have to see conspiracies and everything? I don't control the Russians, and I didn't deliver him.
You're really pushing that innocence today, ain't you?
Quit bickering, idiots, hollers Frau Knob, and clear for action.
Lazy and spectral pitches the Anubis, growing no clearer as they close with her. Springer reaches a megaphone out of the pilot house and bawls,
Good day, Protalovsky. Permission to come aboard.
The answer is a gunshot. Springer hits the deck. Slicker, in rattling yellow flow, lies on his back with the megaphone pointing up, funneling rain in his mouth.
We'll have to, without permission, then, motioning Slothrop over. Get ready to board, to Frau Knob. We'll want to lash on.
Fine, but one look at the evil leer now lighting up Otto's mother's face, and it's clear that she didn't come out today for money.
When do I get to ram her?
Alone on the sea with the Anubis. Slothrop has begun to sweat unpleasantly. The green rocky coast of Rügen backdrops them, rising and falling through the squall. Zong, another shot, rattlesnaking off of a bulkhead.
Ram, orders the Springer. The storm comes down in earnest. Gleeful Frau Knob, humming through her teeth, spins the wheel, spokes blurring, prow swinging over, aiming for midships.
The blank side of the Anubis rushes in. Is the Frau going to bust on through it like a paper hoop?
Faces behind portals, cook peeling potatoes outside the galley, drunk in a frock coat, sleeping on the rainy deck and sliding as the ship rolls. Ah, yeah, yeah, huge blue-flowered bowl of shredded potatoes at her elbow, a window cast-iron flowers on spiral vine all painted white, a mild smell of cabbage and dish rags from under the sink, an apron bow snug and tight above her kidneys and lambs about her legs, and yeah, little, oh, yeah, here comes little, ah, here comes little, ah!
Otto! Slams her boat into the Anubis, a most god-awful, ear-splitting Otto!
Stand by! Springer's on his feet. Protzelovsky is turning away and increasing engine speed. Frau Knob moves up again on the yacht's starboard quarter, wallowing in her wake. Otto passes out grappling hooks, long in Hanseatic service, iron, pitted, functional-looking, as Mutti puts it, all head full. Couples have wandered out under awnings on the Anubis to watch the fun, pointing, laughing, gaily waving. Girls, their nude breasts beaded with rain, blow kisses while the band plays a Guy Lombardo arrangement of Running Between the Raindrops.
Up the slippery ladder goes Salty and buccaneering Slothrop, hefting his grappling hook, letting out line, keeping an eye on that Otto, wind up, spin like a lasso, whee, clank.
Springer and Otto at bow and stern are grappling on at the same time, hauling in as the vessels hit, bounce, hit, but the Anubis, soft white, has slowed, sprawled, allowed.
Otto gets line around chocks forward and up around the scrimshawed railing of the yacht, then dashes aft, sneakers splashing, ribbed footprints left behind, then reined out to repeat the lashing there. A newly arranged river roars, white and violent, backward between the two ships. Springer is already up on the yacht's main deck. Slothrop tucks Luger in belt and follows. Springer, with the classic gangster head move, gestures him up the bridge. Slothrop moves through groping hands, greetings in broken Russian, puffs of alcoholic breath, around to the ladder on the port side, climbing, edging quietly onto the bridge. But Protzelovsky is only sitting in the captain's chair, smoking one of Springer's amis with his cap tilted back, and Springer's just at the punchline to one of his giant repertoire of German toilet jokes.
What the devil, Gerhardt? Protzelovsky waving a thumb. The Red Army's working for you, too?
Hello again, Antony.
The three silver stars on each of his epaulets twinkle howdy, but it's no good.
I don't know you, to the Springer. All right, it's in the engine room, starboard side, down behind the generator, which is Slothrop's cue to leave.
At the bottom of the ladder, he meets Stefania coming along the passageway.
Hi, sorry we have to meet again this way.
Hello, I'm Stefania, shuttering a fast smile as she passes. There's liquor next deck up. Enjoy yourself.
Already gone, out in the rain. What? Slothrop steps down through a hatchway, starts to climb down toward the engineering spaces. Somewhere above him, three bells strike, slowly, a little hollow, with a slight echo. It's late.
Late!
He remembers where he is. Just as he touches the deck, all the lights go out. Air blowers wind down in stillness. The engine room is down one more deck. Will he have to do this in the dark?
I can't, out loud.
You can,
replies a voice close to his ear. He can feel its breath. He is smashed expertly at the base of the neck. Light loops through the pitch dark. His left arm has gone numb.
I'll leave you the other one, the voice whispers, for climbing down to the engine room.
Wait! It feels like the pointed toe of a dancing pump, in out of nowhere to hover a second and stroke the soft underside of his chin. Then it flicks up, slamming his teeth shut on his tongue. The pain is awful. He tastes blood. Sweat gathers next to his eyes.
Move now.
When he hesitates, he is pinched on the back of the neck. Oh, it hurts. He holds to the ladder, night blind, starting to cry. Then he thinks of the Luger, but before he can get to it, he's been kicked viciously between hip and groin. The gun falls to the steel deck. Slothrop is down on one knee, groping, when the shoe descends lightly on his fingers.
You will need this hand for holding on to the ladder, remember?
Remember? Then the shoe is lifted, but only to kick him under the armpit. Up, up! Slothrop gropes to the next ladder, makes his stiff, one-armed way down onto it. He feels the steel hatch opening rise around him.
Don't try to come back up till you've done what you have to do.
Tanats,
Clothrop's tongue hurts. The name comes out clumsily. Silence. Morituri? No answer. Clothrop moves one foot up one rung. No, I'm still here. As he edges downward, shaking rung by rung, feeling prickles back into his arm, how can he go down? How can he go up? He tries to concentrate on the pain. His feet strike steel plate, finally. Blindness. He moves to starboard, colliding at every step with shin-high edges, sharp projections. I don't want to. How can I? Reach down behind bare hands. What if... A sudden whine to his right, something mechanical. He jumps, breath sucking very cold between teeth, nerves in back and arms off and on, skittering. He reaches a cylindrical barrier, might be the generator, stoops and begins to... His hand closes on stiff taffeta. He jerks it away, tries to get up, slams his head against something sharp. He wants to crawl back toward the ladder, but has lost all sense of direction now. He squats, turning in a circle slowly. Let it end. Let it end. But his hands pawing the deck return to slippery satin. No. Yes, hooks and eyes. He breaks a fingernail, trying to lose them, but they follow, lacing that moves, snake-sure, entangling, binding each finger. No! He rises to a crouch, moves forward into something hanging from the overhead. Icy little thighs, in wet silk, swing against his face. They smell of the sea. He turns away, only to be lashed across the cheek by long, wet hair. No matter which way he tries to move now, cold nipples, the deep cleft of her buttocks, perfume and shit, and the smell of brine, and the smell of... When the lights come back on, Clothrop is on his knees, breathing carefully. He knows he will have to open his eyes. The compartment reeks now with suppressed light, with mortal possibilities for light, as the body, in times of great sadness, will feel its real chances for pain, real and terrible and only just under the threshold. The brown paper bundle is 2 inches from his knee, wedged behind the generator, but it's what's dancing dead white and scarlet at the edges of his sight. And are the ladders back up and out really as empty as they look? Back on the Frau's boat, Springer is out with a bottle of champagne, courtesy of the Anubis, untwisting the bright wires and firing the cork in a farewell salvo. Slothrop's hands are shaking, and he spills most of his. Antonia and Stefania watch from the bridge as the two vessels pull apart, Baltic sky visible through the backs of their eyes. Her white hair in filaments of foam, her cheeks sculptured fog, cloud man, fog wife. They dwindle, aloof, silent, back into the heart of the storm. The Frau heads south, along the other coast of Rügen, into the straits by way of the Bug. The storm keeps pace as night comes down. We'll put in at Stralsund, her scrawled face streaming with lube green shadow, yellow light as the oil lantern sways in the pilot house. Slothrop reckons he'll get off there, head for that Cuxhaven. Springer, you think you'll have those papers for me on time? I can't guarantee anything, says Gerhard von Göhl. At Stralsund, on the quay, in the lamplight and the rain, they say goodbye. Frau Knab kisses Slothrop, and Otto gives him a pack of lucky strikes. The Springer looks up from his green notebook and nods Auf Wiedersehen over his pince-nez. Slothrop walks away over the brow, into the wet Hafenplatz, sea legs trying to balance rolling he's left behind, past booms and masts and strung tackle of derricks, past a crew on the night shift offloading the creaking lighters into wood wagons, bowed gray horses kissing the grassless stones. Goodbyes in his pockets, warming his empty hands. Where is the Pope whose staff will bloom for me? Her mountain vamps me back with silks and scents. Her oiled athletic slaves, her languid hints of tortures transubstantiate to sky, to purity of light, of bonds that sing, and whips that trail their spectra as they fall. At weather's mercy now I find her call at every turn at night's foregathering. I've left no sickly sorrow's fate behind. I made my last confession as I knelt agnostic in the radiance of his jewel. Here, underneath my last and splintering wind, no song, no lust, no memory, no guilt, no pentacles, no cups, no holy fool. Brigadier Pudding died back in the middle of June of a massive E. coli infection. Whining at the end. Me little Mary hurts over and over. It was just before dawn as he had wished. Katya stayed on at the white visitation for a while, roaming the demobbed corridors, smoky and still at the ends of all the emptied lattices of cages in the laboratory, herself part of the ash-colored web, the thickening dust and fly-pocked windows. One day she found the cans of film, stacked carelessly by Webley Silvernail, in what had been a music room occupied now only by a disintegrating Wittmeyer harpsichord no one played, quills and stops broken painfully, strings left to sharp, flat, or corrode in the busy knives of weather pushing relentlessly into all the rooms. Pointsman happened that day to be up in London, working out of 12th House, lingering at alcoholic luncheons with his various industrialists. Was he forgetting her? Would she be free? Was she already? Out of apparently nothing more than the emptiness of the white visitation, she finds a projector, threads a reel, and focuses the image on a water-stained wall next to a landscape of some northern coombe with daft aristocrats larking about. She sees a white-haired girl in Pirate Prentice's Chelsea maisonette, a face so strange that she has recognized the medieval rooms before she does herself. When did they... Ah, the day Osby Feel was processing the Amanita mushrooms. Fascinated, she stares at 20 minutes of herself in pre-Piscean fugue. What on earth did they use it for? The answer to that one's in the can, too, and it isn't long before she finds it. Octopus Grigori in his tank watching the Katya footage. Clip after clip, flickering screen and cutaways to Octopus G, staring, each with its typewritten date, showing the improvement in the creature's conditioned reflex. Spliced on at the end of all this, inexplicably, is what seems to be a screen test of Osby Feel, of all people. There is a soundtrack. Osby is improvising a scenario for a movie he's written entitled Doper's Greed. We open with Nelson Eddy in the background singing, Doper's greed, oh, doper's greed, it's the most disgusting thing I ever seed. When you're out there feeling fine, it'll turn you into swine if you ever get a taste of doper's greed. Now into town ride two trail-weary cowboys, Basil Rathbone and S.Z. Cuddles Sakal. At the entrance to town, barring their way, stands the midget who played the lead in Freaks, the one with the German accent. He is the town sheriff. He is wearing an enormous gold star that nearly covers his chest. Rathbone and Sakal rein up with uneasy smiles on their faces. Rathbone. That can't possibly be real, can it? Sakal. Hoo-hoo! Of course that's real, you wretched addict. You went and chewed too much of that weird cactus back down the trail. You should have smoked that nice weed I had, I told you. Rathbone, with his nervous, sickly smile. Please, I don't need a Jewish mother. I know what's real and what isn't real. The midget, meanwhile, is posturing in different tough hombre attitudes and waving a brace of gigantic colts about. Sakal. Then you've been out on the trail, and you know which trail, too, don't you, you sniveling punk? For as long as I have, you know a real midget sheriff from a hallucinated one. Rathbone, I hadn't known either class existed. You must obviously have seen midget sheriffs all over this territory, or else you would hardly have invented the category. Oh, or would you? You know you're just dodgy enough to try anything. Sakal, you forgot, you old rascal. Rathbone, you old rascal. They laugh, draw their guns, and exchange a few playful shots. The midget is rushing back and forth, furious, emitting high-pitched German-accented westernisms like, this town ain't big enough for both of us. Sakal, well, we're both seeing him. That means he's real. Rathbone, joint hallucination is not unknown in our world, partner. Sakal, who says it's joint hallucination? Hoo-hoo! If it was any kind of hallucination, I'm not saying it is now, it would be peyote or Jimson weed, maybe. This interesting conversation goes on for an hour and a half. There are no cuts. The midget is active the whole time, reacting to the many subtle and now and then dazzling points presented. Occasionally, the horses will shit in the dust. It is not clear if the midget knows that his reality is being discussed. Another of this film's artful ambiguities. Finally, Rathbone and Sakal agree that the only way to settle the argument is to kill the midget, who gathers their intention and runs off screaming down the street. Sakal laughs so hard he falls off his horse into the horse trough, and we get a final close-up of Rathbone smiling in his uncertain way. Fade-up song. When you're out there feeling fine, it'll turn you into swine if you ever get a taste of doper's greed. There is a brief epilogue to this, with Osby trying to point out that, of course, the element of greed must be worked somehow into the plot line in order to justify the title, but the film runs out in the middle of an Katya by now is in a bewildered state, but she knows a message when she sees it. Someone, a hidden friend at the White Visitation, perhaps Silvernail himself, who's been less than fanatically loyal to Pointsman and his lot, has planted Osby Field's screen test deliberately here, where they knew she'd find it. She rewinds and runs the film again. Osby is looking straight into the camera, straight at her. None of your idle doper's foolery here. He's acting. There's no mistake. It is a message, in code, which, after not too long, she busts as follows.
say that Basil Rathbone stands for young Osby himself. S.Z. Sakal may be Mr. Pointsman, and the midget sheriff the whole dark, grandiose scheme, wrapped in one small package, diminished, a clear target. Pointsman argues that it's real, but Osby knows better. Pointsman ends up in a stack.